I thought that was very nice in the meditation. There seemed to be quite a lot of stillness in the room, didn't there? So I wonder why sometimes the meditation is still in here, sometimes not. Is it just a random thing? Is it just who happens to be here and how, what state of mind they're in? Is it the leader? Is it the weather? Is it something that comes together between people?
It comes together.
It comes together, you think, yeah.
Yeah.
Say that again. Maybe it's the supermoon.
Yeah.
But in a way, this is the theme that we're looking at, is the whole theme of how do things, why are things the way they are? Why do situations happen as they do, you know? To start to come to terms with that in a way and see whether one can develop what you might call a dharmic, a Buddhist perspective on it. So if you think back to that, the end of that meditation, or even, let's say, the point in the meditation when you could detect the stillness in yourself and in others, you just, well, here is a particular state of affairs. Now, this is now. This is my experience now, isn't it? Here it is. Now, that state of affairs emerged from whatever there was before then. Mm. 1 second before, but also 5 minutes before, an hour before, a year before, a century before, it's all been converging. It's as if the whole of the past has converged on that one point of the now. And the now, this now that we're always dwelling in, the now that there was then, when it was still, the now that there is now when it's a little bit different in here, you know. So, in a way, it's okay, that's interesting, isn't it? The sense that, okay, it has arisen from previous circumstances, previous situations and experiences, and there's a constant transition going on. There's a transition from one state of affairs to another state of affairs. A new state of affairs is arising all the time. So this is what reality is. Reality is a flow of experiences. And you could say according to Buddhism, but it's not really according. It just is, isn't it, really? This is, our reality is a flow of experiences. It's never still, it's never static, and it's never stuck, although sometimes it seems stuck. Sometimes the situation feels stuck or feels repetition. It feels as if, you know, I've been through this before, haven't I? And I didn't like it last time, and I don't like it this time, and I wish it would go away. So there is that sense sometimes, isn't there? But nevertheless, actually, if we're honest, it's different. We may try to make it the same. There may be part of us that is hanging on desperately to keep it the same, but really it's all a river. Reality is a river. We're each a river, or we're each, if you like, a current, a small current within a river, within the vast river of everything. So things come to be, they move on, and they pass out of existence, they pass away. They're rising and they're falling. So I hope that gives you a general sense of this is the theme that we're looking at the moment, that sort of theme of rising and falling. But Buddhism, in a way, makes use of that fact and builds on it and adds something to the whole idea of rising and falling, of change, of impermanence. And basically, there is a crucial teaching, I suppose, about the flow, which is that you can, you can understand it, or you can realise it, or you can attend to it fully. It's not meaningless. It's not the whim of some capricious being. You know, like in some religions, you might have the sense of you're being zapped the whole time by some... or maybe even a benign being that's blessing you the whole time. But no, according to Buddhism, no, it's not like that. It's not haphazard. It's not whim. If you like, it's scientific. There are reasons, there are causes that can be understood. The processes flow into each other in law-governed ways. You can work out what those laws are And in a general sort of sense of physics and chemistry and biology, that's what science is doing. But when it comes to our own human mind, our psychology, our human experience, our experience of life, that's what Buddhism is trying to do, is to discover those laws, or to help us to discover them. Not so much to write them down, you know, A equals leads to B and so on, but more to show you ways of seeing them directly, the way things fit together, the way things flow into each other. So that means that it's possible for us to come to terms with our situation, even to understand our situation, our now, by looking carefully at our then, at our past. If you do have a sense of your past, of how you arrived here, you can have a much fuller sense of what this is about. But even more crucially, we can create our next from our now. The then becomes the now becomes the next. The next might just happen because we just let it happen, but we can intervene at the point of the now, and we can make the next, we can mould the next, we can create it like a work of art. And our next depends on both how we look at our now, how we understand it, and also what we do with it, how we act now. So in Buddhism, this process and all its laws is known as conditioned arising, pratitya samutpada, pratitya samutpada, conditioned arising, or more commonly people just call it conditionality. The great network of conditionality, the Indra's net of conditionality. And this is the theme of these talks. So I thought for this talk, near the beginning of the series, it might be interesting to look at the conditioned arising of the Buddha, of a Buddha. How does a Buddha come to be? The first historical Buddha, in fact, the man who founded Buddhism. What was it that started the Buddha off? I thought that might be an interesting thing. So I'm not going to talk much more about conditioned arising as a whole. I'm just going to say, well, let's look at the conditions. Let's look at what happened. Let's look at what he did with his experiences, his early experiences in particular. And some of this will probably be very, very familiar to you, but see if you can listen to the story afresh of those experiences that led the Buddha to become a Buddha, or led the Buddha before he was a Buddha to become the Buddha. So what did start the Buddha off? Well, biologically speaking, he presumably started off when his mum and his dad were making love one night, and she had a dream of an elephant with six tusks, and when she woke up, she realised, I'm pregnant. So that is one starting point, isn't it? But there's no absolute starting point. You can always go beyond that, can't you? You can go before that, staying with biology. His conception was preceded by all the gradual genetic changes through generations of his ancestors back and back into the dim pre-human past. Those footsteps leading back into the mist, you know, which you can almost see if you look at those amazing fossilized footprints they found in Kenya, you know, of two, a man and a woman and a child walking across the volcanic ash 3 million years ago. It's amazing to think that, you know. So you can look back through those footprints through time. But there's even other starts. Chemically, physically, he started in the molecules that coalesced in his mother's womb to form his body, or in the leaves where the molecules were first synthesized from sunlight and gases that became her food. But in the stars, even before that, where the atoms fused from primordial hydrogen, even before that, when it all started in the Big Bang, maybe even before that, who knows? And then psychologically, he was formed by his childhood experiences, by his education, even, if you believe the Buddhist point of view, by the relics of all his previous lives. So we can see this amazing network of conditions that gave a rise to the Buddha. You know, I've mentioned his conception. I mentioned the biology, the evolution that led there. I mentioned the physics and the chemistry of the atoms. I've mentioned his childhood, his education, all these things that formed him, his previous lives. But which one of these is the most significant? Well, from again, from a Buddhist point of view, it's something else that's significant, even more significant than his upbringing, even more significant than his body, the kind of body he had, the cultural history he entered. And this is the moment that he decided to seek awakening. So it seems to me that the real, really interesting starting point for the Buddha is when he made a decision, when he was living as a fairly ordinary person, having his trials and tribulations, having his delights, marriage, all that kind of thing, being trained for his job in the future, which was to, as a leader in his country, and all that kind of thing, normal stuff. Then he decides, no, I'm not going to go for this. I'm going to seek enlightenment. So that seems to me to be a really, for me at least, that's the most interesting starting point. What led to that decision? And is it something that we can relate to as well? You know, maybe it's not like a one-off decision, flipping from being an ordinary person to being a person seeking enlightenment for us. Maybe it's more, it sort of flips and flops all around the place sometimes, doesn't it? You know, but at least you can see that sometimes there's that life of searching, that life of significance, that life of trying to wake up, trying to be awake. And I'm sure we probably all experience that sometimes. And it's interesting to look back in one's own life and say, what triggers that sort of thing? What triggers that kind of experience in me? What causes that to arise? What causes it to fall when it weakens, when it goes away? And when I find the burdens of life are just too much, really, to be actually actively seeking to be more awake. So I'm going to tell you the story, which I'm sure you've heard before. Because he later described what happened and what it was like. And there are loads and loads of elements to this. Some of them may be legendary. We don't know, in a way. Some of them may be legendary. But we've got the image of him being given a very protective life by his father. He's the heir. He's the oldest son. So he's going to be groomed for leadership. He's trained in martial arts. He's trained in the lineages of his tribe and the old legends, you know, in our case, it'd be like in England, somebody being learning the legends of King Arthur. He was taught all these old legends of his tribe. And he was also given lots to get himself distracted by, I suppose you could say. So apparently his father gave him three houses, and he would move between them in the different seasons of the year. You know, so when it was too hot, he'd go up into the hills. And he'd have a house up, a lovely, cool house up in the hills with the woods around it. You know, when the monsoon started, he'd go down into the plains and stay there. And he had another house for the winter season as well. And these houses were full of dancing girls, is the way it's described. I don't know, you know, in a way it's as if he had, in modern terms, he had, you know, big screen, multi-channel. He had lots of distraction, lots of parties going on all the time. Maybe going out hunting, going out having archery competitions and racing your horses and all sorts of things, you know. So there he is. And his father is very worried that he doesn't want him to get distracted from this because he's shown signs of discontent. And this is not a very good thing, these signs of discontent. So he tries to really protect him. And according to, this probably is legendary, but according to legend, his father said, when he saw his father, when he was getting just bored with this life, his father said, well, why don't you just go out, you know, go out, take your chariot out, and just go for a drive, you know, and just have a look around. And he'd been so sheltered that he wasn't really aware of the country around him, according to the legend. His father said, why don't you go out? But his father sort of planned a particular day for it. And according to the story, he sent people out to hide all the beggars out of sight, all the poor people out of sight, all the sick people out of sight. Everything that might bother the Buddha, they were all hustled away out of sight so that they wouldn't distract him. And he could go through the lovely countryside. And only the nice, the good-looking people were allowed to line the streets and wave their little flags as the prince goes by, you know, and take their selfies of him with him, and whatever they do in those days. Little sketches, make a little sketch, you know, I suppose. So off he goes, trots off with his charioteer through the countryside. This is very nice, isn't it? Very interesting. You know, what's that hill called over there? You know, what's that town? You know, everybody cheering and waving. Because he was apparently very handsome, the ladies were on their balconies, you know, putting on their nicest jewels, you know, rattling them as he went by. But then he sees something. Mm. And what does he see? He sees an old man. Mm. He sees an old man. And it's as if he's never seen an old man before. Some of these, I'll read you from the Buddhacharita, the way these little episodes are described. There are lots of different descriptions, but this one is actually a literary version. One of the earliest actual biographies of the Buddha, written by Ashvaghosha, the Buddhacharita, it's called. And Ashvaghosha was a very great Sanskrit playwright who lived a good 1,000 years after the Buddha, but still a long, long time ago, but one of the greatest writers of ancient India. And as well as plays, he wrote, this is maybe his best known book, is a biography of the Buddha, the Buddhacharita, which means what the Buddha got up to. Charita means what you do, you know, how you behave, the course of your life. It's called here the Acts of the Buddha, the slightly Christianized version. So the Buddhacharita, very poetic, very beautiful, the way it's expressed. So he sees an old man. The prince saw him, overcome with senility and different in form to other men. And he asked the charioteer, "Good charioteer, who's this man with white hair supporting himself on the staff in his hand, with his eyes veiled by his beetling brows, his limbs all soft and bent? Is this some transformation in him? Is he always been like this?" And the charioteer says, "Old age this is called, that which has broken him down, the murderer of beauty, the ruin of vigour, the birthplace of sorrow, the grave of pleasure, the destroyer of memory, the enemy of the senses." And he says, "Will this evil come upon me as well?" And of course the charioteer says, "Yeah, not just you, but everybody. We're all going to get old. Nothing you can do about that." And he said, I'm not enjoying this drive anymore. Let's go home." So they turned the chariot round and went home, and he's sort of brooding and bothered, you know. And then sometime later, out he goes again. And this time he sees a sick man. "Who is this man with swollen belly and a body that heaves with his panting? His shoulders and arms are fallen in. His limbs are emaciated and pale. He calls out piteously, 'Mother!' And he leans on another person for support. 'Good sir, it's the mighty misfortune called disease, developed in full force from the disorder of the humours, that has made this man, once so competent, no longer a master of himself.'" And then he says, "This evil is shared by all. You too will fall ill. You too will become diseased." And then, of course, goes back, very sobered by all this. And then a third time, out they go. Everything happens to happen in three. A good legend has to have things happening in threes, doesn't it? So the third one. "Who's being carried along yonder by four men and followed by a dejected company? He's beautifully dressed, but yet they all bewail him. 'This is somebody or other, don't know who, lying bereft of intellect, bereft of senses, bereft of his breath and his qualities, no longer conscious, become like a mere log or a bundle of grass. He was brought up and cherished most lovingly with every care, but now he's being abandoned to the grave. This is the last act for all creatures. Destruction is inevitable for all in the world, whether you're of low, middle, or high degree. And in each of these cases, the Buddha-to-be, he says he can't understand how people can enjoy themselves when this is going on. This is the end appointed for all creatures. Yet the world throws off fear, takes no heed. Harden are men's hearts, for they're in good cheer as they fare along the road, despite the presence of this corpse. How could a man of intelligence be heedless here in the hour of calamity, when once he knows of this destruction and that it is for everybody? So those are the four sites. We're going to hear about the fourth one in a minute. So those are the first three sites that the Buddha sees. And it's a very strong story, I think, somehow. It's sort of so ordinary, in a way, and all of them are so ordinary, and we really know about the reality of old age, sickness, and of death. Even from childhood, we know about it, in a sense, don't we? But then it sort of comes home, doesn't it? And you realise, yeah, I'm getting older. I am getting older. Or you look up, and when you're younger, you look up at your parents. You remember how vigorous they were once. And then you see them gradually becoming old people. You see them sick, falling sick. You see people very precious to you falling sick. You feel it in yourself. You feel maybe energetic, but then you're struck down by something, you know. And you can't do it. And what's happening with me at the moment, I've reached the age where I'm having problems with teeth. And another tooth goes, and another tooth goes wrong or something, you know. And it's going to happen to you as well, I warn you. Teeth are not permanent. And neither is anything else in the body. But it is really good just to, in a way, what the lesson is. Yeah, just look at those things. Let's look at them. But of course, from the Buddha's point of view, he just goes back really dejected. In a way, that's the trouble. If you look at them, you just feel, what's that point? You know, if this is what life is about, what on earth is the point? You know, it just seems to, here it is, I put so much effort into building up a life that works for me, the right career, the right partner, the right house, and the right possessions, and the right set of opinions, all that kind of thing. I put so much effort into building it up, but it's just gonna lose it. I'm going to lose my abilities in sickness and old age. I'm even going to lose the very possibility of enjoying it all, because I'm going to die. So in a way, maybe you best not think about it. Maybe it's best just to ignore it, you know. And presumably everybody does that, you know. We do think about it, and then we think, oh, I'd better not think about that, you know. So perhaps in a way he was unusual in that he wasn't prepared to do that, but he didn't know what to do. He did not know what to do. He had all these fallings. He reflected on these fallings of the loss of your youth, the loss of your health, the loss even of your life. And in one of the suttas he says, when I really became aware of aging, the intoxication with youth left me. Mm-hmm. And when I really became aware of sickness, the intoxication with health left me. And when I really became aware of death, the intoxication with life left me. So he felt as if he was a little bit drunk, which you can, you know, in a way it's quite nice. If you are feeling full of energy and full of beans and all that kind of thing, and you're racing around, you're playing football and you're going to the beach and all that kind of thing, it's nice. But he felt, I don't want to forget. I feel I was intoxicated. I feel the intoxication meant I forgot the context I was in, the real context of the transiency of life. Not just for me, but for everybody. So then what's the fourth sight? So the fourth sight is a wanderer. So in this occasion, he goes out, and this, for some reason, at least in this version, instead of going on the chariot, he decides to ride on his horse for this one. So he rides off on his horse, and he's still got his charioteer with him, and he spots a wanderer. And he spots somebody who just impresses him enormously by his whole demeanour. And who's different, somebody who's different and behaving differently. Let's see what Ashvaghosha, the way Ashvaghosha describes this. So he'd already been thinking about what he'd seen, and he says, "A wretched thing it is indeed that man, who's himself helpless and subject to the laws of old age, disease and death, should in his ignorance and the blindness of his conceit pay no heed to other people, who are also victims of old age, disease and death. For if I, who am prey to these things, should pay no heed to another whose nature is equally such, it would not be right or fitting in me, who have knowledge of this, that I've seen of the law of impermanence." And thus he gained insight into the evils of disease, old age and death, and the mental intoxication relating to the self, which arises from belief in one's strength, one's youth and one's life, and that intoxication left him in a moment. He didn't rejoice, but yet he was not downcast. Doubt did not come over him, nor sloth nor drowsiness. He felt no longing for sensual pleasures. He felt no hatred or contempt for others. And while this state of mind grew within his mind, there came up to him a man in the clothes of a wanderer. And the king's son, Gautama, asked him, "Tell me, who are you?" And thus he explained to him, "I am a Shramana. And in fear of birth and death, I've left the home life for the sake of liberation. Since the world is subject to destruction, I desire rescue from that, and I seek the blessed incorruptible stage of enlightenment. I look with equal mind on kinsman and stranger. Longing for and hatred of the objects of sense have passed from me. I dwell wherever I happen to be, at the root of a tree, or in an old ruin, or a hill, or in the forest. I wander without ties or expectations in search of the highest good, accepting any alms I may receive for my food." So that's the fourth sight. The wondrous wanderer. The idea, this possibility of seeking for the truth. And in a simpler version of the events, which is probably more authentic, the Buddha says, "Before my enlightenment, while I was still an unenlightened bodhisattva, I saw that I was subject to birth. I was subject to aging, sickness, death. I was subject to sorrow and defilement. But I realized that I was seeking the same things. I was seeking what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement. Why do I do that? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to these things? Suppose, being myself subject to aging, but understanding the danger in what is subject to aging, I seek the unaging, the supreme security from bondage, awakening, freedom, nirvana. So, later on, while I was still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessings of youth, in the prime of life, although my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair, I shaved off my beard, I put on the yellow robe, I went forth from the home life into homelessness. I went forth in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, seeking freedom." So this is what the Buddha did. He sort of followed that example. He followed that example of the wanderer. So it's as if, stimulated by the realization of these losses, the loss of aging, the loss of sickness, the loss of death, he wanted to look for something that was a gain, in a way. He thought he wanted to create something. He wanted to create himself, I suppose you could say. And he didn't know what the answer was going to be. He presumably had an intuition that liberation from these traps was possible. He calls it bondage, liberation from bondage. He felt he was in bondage to old age, disease and death. And he wanted to find liberation. He didn't know what that was going to be. He had no idea. He knew he talked to his father about it, and there's another account in here, which I won't read you out, where he goes to his father and said, I'm going to leave. I can't stand this anymore. And his father said, look, no, I'll give you anything. You could, but why don't I retire now? Look, after all, it's much better. I'm much older than you. I can do that. I can go and become a wanderer and look for the truth. We need someone to run the country. You know, we need someone to look after this very important job. And the Buddha said, okay, give me in one condition. If you can protect me, if you can promise to protect me from aging, sickness and death, I'll do the job. And his father said, I can't do that. I'm sorry, I cannot do that. And he said, in that case, I'm going, I'm looking, I'm going to seek for the truth. And so off he goes, looking for liberation. And eventually, he succeeds. Now, in a way, I don't know how he does it and what it is he does. You know, they seem insurmountable problems. It seems that, after all, he himself did get sick. He did get old. He did die. So it's not that he solved them in that literal sense that he found immortality or something like that. But yet, somehow, he says, I have found the deathless. When he gained enlightenment, that's the way he puts it. I have found, what on earth is going on? He says he found the deathless. But yet, he went on, he died, you know. So it's all very weird. But I've got a sort of a sense that he probably did find it. And in a way, that's the sense that enlightenment somehow is, in a way, a state in which the oppression, the bondage that comes from things rising and falling has gone away. Because you've let go, you're no longer intoxicated by youth and health and life. You're allowing things to be as they are. You're dwelling in that flowing present moment the whole time. And somehow, while he was sitting under the Bodhi tree, years later, it took him years, but it didn't happen overnight, it took him years, but years later he's sitting under the Bodhi tree and he sees that river of conditionality. He sees it flowing before him. He realizes how it works. He first of all looks back into his own past and he sees what has taken him to be this kind of a person, this kind of a person with these problems and these difficulties and these habits and these qualities. And then he looks at other people in the second watch of the light and he sees why people are as they are. He tries to understand the psychology of humanity. He tries to understand how everybody has come to their situation through these long processes of conditionality. And then in the third watch of the night, he sees the whole network of conditionality. He sees how it all fits together. He realizes conditioned arising under the Bodhi tree. And next week, Bodhi Leela is going to tell us about that. Well, not necessarily the Bodhi tree part, but at least this being that becomes the general significance of conditioned arising. So anyone can see these four sights. Anyone can see old age, sickness and death. Anyone can see a very impressive person who's clearly at least looking for the truth, even if they haven't found it. But it's the significance that we bring to them that matters. It's not the fact of seeing them. It's the significance we bring to them. And not just the significance, but it's whether you do something with it, whether you act. You've got to understand conditioning and you've got to act on the basis of it. You've got to see these sights. And then we can surf on impermanence, or we can ride that wave that flows into and out of the cave, not swept along by them, but riding them. The other image I have for this, what you're trying to do with impermanence, is that sometimes it feels you're the Buddha on this horse, galloping along, but actually you haven't even quite got on it, and your foot's caught in the reins, and the horse is galloping away, and you fall over, and you're being dragged, and eventually you've got to somehow get yourself up and run alongside, and then just you jump on the horse. The horse is not going to stop. The horse of impermanence, you can't just say, come on, stop, stop, stop. It's not going to do it. It keeps galloping along. But we need to be on that horse. We need to be riding through life. And then imagine, you can have a great time. Imagine you're a really good rider, and you're sort of riding through the hills and enjoying life. So you notice your experience, you learn from it, you remember what you've learnt, you dwell on it, you let it sink home, You let it touch you. If your experience is of old age or sickness of or death, you let it touch you. If your experience is of the possibility of going forth, the possibility of liberation, you let that touch you as well. You let it affect you. And I don't know what it's going to mean for you. When you do see it, it's going to mean something, and it's going to mean action. But I don't know what the action will be. It'll mean you'll need to do something with it. And then you're changing your life. So I thought I'd finish with, you may be familiar with this, it's a very beautiful poem by Rilke. And it seems to me that this is to do with what happened with Rilke when he went to, I think it may have been the Louvre, he was living in Paris at the time, and he went to one of the museums, and in the museum he saw an old statue, an old Greek statue, very ancient, 2,000 years old, of the god Apollo. And it was missing a head, and it was known as the archaic torso of Apollo, and it's just this really amazing human torso, carved by a master, by one of the greatest sculptors ever, I suppose. And he looks at this, it's known as the archaic torso of Apollo. And this is what he wrote. "We cannot know his legendary head with eyes like ripening fruit. And yet his torso is still suffused with brilliance from inside, like a lamp in which his gaze, now turned to low, gleams in all its power. Otherwise the curved breast could not dazzle you so, nor could a smile run through the placid hips and thighs to that dark centre where procreation flared. Otherwise this stone would seem defaced beneath the translucent cascade of the shoulders and would not glisten like a wild beast's fur. It would not, from all the borders of itself, burst like a star. Burst like a star. For here there is no place that does not see you. You must change your life." I'll read that again, actually, because it takes a bit of absorbing. So remember, you've got this image of the torso, of the beautiful statue of Apollo. "We cannot know his legendary head with eyes like ripening fruit. And yet his torso is still suffused with brilliance from inside, like a lamp in which his gaze, now turned to low, gleams in all its power. Otherwise the curved breast could not dazzle you so, nor could a smile run through the placid hips and thighs to that dark centre where procreation flared. Otherwise, this stone would seem defaced beneath the translucent cascade of the shoulders and would not glisten like a wild beast's fur. Would not, from all the borders of itself, burst like a star. For here there is no place that does not see you. You must change your life." And so I'll leave it there. Yeah, it's just something on the foresights. And on, in a way, sometimes a vision, something that we see, changes us. Mm. For Rilke, it was seeing the torso. For the Buddha, it was seeing the wanderer. It was seeing a human being who was really making something of his life. And maybe there's something of the same in those two experiences. Rilke was changed by seeing the statue. The Buddha was changed by seeing the wanderer.